Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to take part in our process here on the Exchange, join our discussion at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send us an email. That goes to jx@jeffnet.org. Tourists come from all over the country to walk the streets of Jacksonville, Oregon. It was once the seat of Jackson County, once a center of mining and industry, and its downtown area is well preserved from that vibrant past, a National Historic District, in fact. What is not apparent to the casual observer is the part of Jacksonville's history that includes a significant population of Chinese people. That period of history and part of town are the focus of an archaeological dig in the old Chinese quarter, and the process includes a public dig coming up next weekend, October 12th. We have two guests with us to talk about the dig and the history and all that are implicated by both. Chelsea Rose is an archaeologist with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. Chelsea, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you here. And Larry Smith joins us once again with one of his many hats. We've talked to him before about the Jacksonville Woodlands Association and all that work. He is a retired teacher. And are you still the unofficial historian of Jacksonville?
Yes.
All right. Nothing official at this point.
No. And good morning, Jeffrey.
Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. So tell us about the each of you, about your work, certainly. And Chelsea, I want to hear from you first about what goes on at SULA, because we have talked to your partner, Mark Tveskov, in the past about all the various digs, but you guys are busy.
We are. We serve most of Southwest Oregon, sometimes beyond that, and we partner with different organizations that need cultural resource management studies done for development or projects or maintenance and stuff like that. So we work with the Department of Transportation, state parks, BLM, cities, stuff like that, to help them when they have archaeological projects they need done. And we like to bring in students, and we are a research facility on campus. So we have students that we come out, or that come out with us to dig, and then also that work in the lab on the analysis and stuff like that as well.
It seems like the digs are pretty frequent, like a couple dozen times a year, maybe?
Oh, yeah, we're busy year round. Yeah.
And Larry Smith, I just want to differentiate again. You are not the Larry Smith who was once the football coach at the University of Missouri.
That's right.
Okay. But you did spend 33 years, was it, teaching at Jacksonville Elementary School?
Yes, and I'm still teaching several days a week as a substitute teacher.
But you're well steeped in the history of Jacksonville. Now, are you part of the Jacksonville Heritage Society? Is that what it's called?
I helped found it, but now it has morphed into another organization and dealing more with events and so on over at Bingham Knoll. But I've made a study of both the pioneer history and the Chinese history of Jacksonville.
All right, so let's get right to it then. The pioneer history is pretty well established. I mean, by the 1850s, had gold already been discovered in Jacksonville? Is that the reason for its existence?
Yeah, 1851. It was just a cove in the Siskiyous up until 1851 when gold was discovered. And within a few weeks or months, 3,000 people were living there in Jacksonville and the surrounding hills.
That fast, really?
Yes, because what had happened was they had moved up from these middle of California gold mines, and they moved up to Yreka, and gold was discovered in Yreka in 1850. So you had pent-up energy right there, and as soon as they found out about gold just 50 miles over the top of the Siskiyous, they poured in there and then spread out over all over southern Oregon.
What an interesting progression, though. The 49ers coming for the big Sutter strike, and then the 50ers in Yreka, and the 51ers essentially in Jacksonville.
Yes.
That's a great story. So then how did so many Chinese people end up in Jacksonville?
Well, it goes back quite a ways when the economic decline in China was happening in the 1840s. The ports were closed. People were not allowed to move out of there. But when gold was discovered in California, wind got back to the Canton area, the Pearl River area, or basically Hong Kong. And the Chinese figured that there was a way of earning a little bit more money. And so they hired onto boats and ships and so on and went over to San Francisco and abandoned ship there and headed off into the gold mines around Marysville and the American River, that area. So there was quite a group of them, but they weren't organized. And so what you had to do is get these cantons going. And so these labor bosses started pulling them together. Some of them could speak English, and they promised to provide food and housing for them if they came in under their control. And it'd be 10, 20, 30, 50 men in these cantons, and they provided all their needs and jobs as best they could. And they usually hired them out for about $2 a day. The boss took a dollar, and that was to provide board and room and for his own pocket. And then the dollar went back to the Chinese, and they earned about $30 a day. I mean, $30 a month.
So it sounds like there weren't many days off.
No, it was 7 days a week. And then they would save up enough money, and the idea was that they would send about $30 a year back to China. And with thousands of Chinese living in California and Oregon, that became quite an economic boom to help out the Chinese government in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
So they were sending it back as dollars?
Yeah, well, probably gold.
All right. So when you talk about them jumping ship in San Francisco, were they generally residing here in ways that the immigration authorities at the time would not have approved of?
That's right. But what happened, it was similar to today. They provided such a source of manpower that they were welcomed for a long time. But then people started realizing they were dressed a little differently. They had cues. They spoke a different language. They had a different religion. They ate different food. And the thing that really got to Chinese miners was these were very healthy people because they ate healthily. They boiled their water before they made their tea. And the white miners were having red meat, which was rotten half the time, and they were drinking out of fouled streams. And so when the miners came down with diseases, they would blame the Chinese for putting hexes on them.
Really?
Yes.
But they were healthier than the white miners.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because drinking tea and fresh vegetables. And the other thing that really bothered a lot of the local business people here, they shipped their food, a lot of their food and their herbs and spices and so on, they shipped them in from China, and they didn't buy locally. And that really bothered the local business people.
Because they weren't patronizing those local businesses.
Yes. All right. Well, they weren't used to this type of food, so they wanted their own kind of food.
Much more to talk about the dig in Jacksonville and the Chinese Quarter, the former Chinese Quarter. We will talk more with Larry Smith, a retired teacher and historian, and Chelsea Rose, the archaeologist from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Larry and Chelsea and your phone calls and emails in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the bit of history that involves the Chinese folks in Jacksonville, Oregon, back in the 1850s and beyond, when there actually was a Chinese quarter in Jacksonville, back when it was the Jackson County seat, which it is no longer. There's an archaeological dig going on there involving the folks at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. Chelsea Rose is one of the archaeologists there and one of our guests here on the Jefferson Exchange. She's also joined by Larry Smith, a retired teacher and historian in Jacksonville. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Larry, I had read one account that indicated that one of the other resentments that came between the white miners and the Chinese miners was that the Chinese miners were willing to stay in some of the nasty conditions in the streams and continue to work the claims after some of the bigger payoffs had begun to disappear. They would work at it a lot harder and longer and end up more successful, ultimately, than some of the folks who just said, ah, forget it, there's no gold here anymore.
The white miners tended to think that just over the next ridge would be the next big gold strike, and so they took off easily to when the digging got a little harder. The Chinese moved in there, and they wore out the dirt. And when they'd come into town with their gold pokes full of gold, the feeling was they're stealing it from the white miners. It wasn't theirs to begin with, because the laws and rules said they couldn't even own gold mines, but whites still sold them their old mines, and then they moved on to bigger mining. At least they hoped they would find it. The other thing that really bothered them was the idea that they were not to belong here. They were called celestials. They were just people, sojourners. They were just passing through, and they were not to stay here. Women were not allowed to come in with them because they didn't want any children born here. They didn't want any citizens coming out of this. So up at the cemetery, eventually, all of the Chinese were removed. And there's an article in the Jacksonville newspaper that said, they didn't buy our food, and they didn't become part of our culture, and not even our dirt is good enough for them.
Really? That was said?
Yes.
Wow.
I can't repeat the exact words.
Okay. Well, thanks for the for holding back just a bit there. Let's take a phone call. Here's Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Larry Smith and Chelsea Rose. We're talking about digging into the past in Jacksonville.
Hi. I love the name Chelsea. That 60s song, Woke Up, It Was a Chelsea Morning. I love that name. Anyway, I lived in Cape Junction for a while, excuse me, and a little town outside, not even a stop sign, Waldo. And I've hiked that mountain, and they said Waldo Cemetery, you know, is filled with Chinese graves, and because they said at one point, I guess that was the seat capital, or the, what do you call it?
Josephine County seat, yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, Waldo, Oregon, of all places, and a dot on the map, barely, and it said that the Chinese at one point when they were done working them, and I've seen tailings from old mines there hiking the mountains, and that they just dug a big pit and pushed them all in and covered them up, and I always wondered, I'm sure you'll know if that's true or not. And also going through Jacksonville years ago, all of a sudden the road's blocked off by an antique religious bookstore, and the truckers are mad, and well, they shouldn't be going through Jacksonville anyway, but because they found some old opium bottles. Oh, instant dig, and I love it. They unearthed some wonderful things there at the edge of town going towards Applegate.
Okay, let's explore what we're talking about. Thanks for the call, Jeannie. Appreciate it. And first of all, Chelsea, yes, your parents like that song, too.
Yeah, I'm named after that song. So, and actually, I can respond to both kind of those questions. The time in Jacksonville when the road was closed off, I think that was 2003 or 2004, that was actually the first professional excavation within the Chinese Quarter that we're going back to explore next week. And that was as part of the Oregon Department of Transportation and the city of Jacksonville doing some work in the road there. And it was the same set of laws and regulations that were prompting that dig are the ones that are prompting the dig we're doing now. And then also about Waldo, we recently did some work over at Waldo. We went out there with our students and we recorded the cemetery and did a site condition assessment to look at, you know, the condition of the resources there and how to preserve it. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about it was the story goes that the Chinese were not allowed up into the white portion of the cemetery. And there is, in fact, two distinct cemeteries there. So when we mapped it all out, we found out that while the up top section, which had the white miners and the residents, was, you know, laid in nice rows, down below, these graves were laid out in the contours and along with kind of the shape of the mountain, which was, in fact, directly aligned with feng shui. And so to me, that was really fascinating because in a way it kind of reclaims part of that story. It wasn't a story just about racism and exclusion, but there's a sense of empowerment to know that the Chinese were actually burying their dead in accordance with their traditional beliefs and customs. So it wasn't just a matter of being excluded from the top. The top cemetery with the orientation that the white miners preferred was not appropriate for them, and it wasn't something that they chose to do. So they did have...
they were excluded from the hilltop, right?
No, not necessarily. Really? I think that that's just how people have interpreted that. You know, this burial custom was more appropriate for them. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, where that line falls. But to me, that story of empowerment and a little bit of agency is one that you don't often hear about in conjunction with the Chinese miners of the area. So there was a lot. The cards were definitely stacked against them, but there definitely are times when they do have control over their lives and their choices they make.
And Waldo was, in fact, a mining community as well. I mean, wasn't it called Sailor Diggings
at
one time?
Waldo's just one section within a larger Sailor Diggings area. There's a lot of other little towns in there. And all that remains of the town is the cemetery because it's on a hill, and the town itself was actually mined. They realized the only place left they hadn't looked for gold was under the streets and buildings of the town, so it's gone.
You mentioned that the 2003 dig in Jacksonville was prompted by a highway work, and so are some of these digs things that wouldn't happen unless somebody was actually doing excavation for another purpose and by law has to make sure that they're cataloging what's there?
Yeah, the majority of archaeology done in America and the majority of working archaeologists are involved in what's called cultural resources management, and that's what we do here. primarily, and that's, you know, where the laws, state and federal laws, require cultural resource investigations, just like they would natural resource investigations, prior to, you know, the destruction of what could be important archaeological sites.
So, well, if it really gets to the point of destruction, I mean, the fact is it's not just a matter of removing things from there, but it's just, it's sort of deciding what is there, but you might just go ahead and just build or pour your concrete or do whatever you're going to do anyway, right?
Yeah, so it's a complicated process, and it is a process, and that's, so the first time we go out, is anything there, yes or no? And then if something is there, you know, ideally you'd go back and say, well, is it important? And we base that criteria on the National Register. Just like buildings would be of historic places. So if it's eligible for that, we would consider it an important or significant archaeological site. And then you have the discussion, can you avoid it? And if not, then you mitigate the damage to that site through data recovery. And that's what we're doing actually in Jacksonville next week. They need to get a sidewalk through there. They need to make some streetscape improvements for the safety and the usability of that neighborhood. And so the project needs to go through, so we're going to go in and we're going to recover the archaeology systematically before it gets impacted by the backhoes.
Culture, history, archaeology, anthropology, and all of it involving the Chinese population in Jacksonville back in the 19th century. We're talking to Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology and Larry Smith, a retired teacher and historian in Jacksonville. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Larry, where was the Chinese Quarter in Jacksonville, and why was there a Chinese Quarter? I guess I know the answer to that. If the cemeteries weren't good enough for the dead, then the parts of town that the white people lived in weren't good enough for the living.
Well, Main Street was started, of course, in the early 1850s, and it was mostly just throw up very shabby shacks. And Main Street is one block off of what is today California Street. So when California Street was formed, and that became the Main Street, and that's the one that went out toward the gold mines in the Applegate, Main Street was somewhat abandoned. Jackson was one of the few towns that has a Main Street that's not the Main Street.
It really is.
It is kind of confusing. You have just a little, very narrow street. And so when the whites moved over, Peter Britt, who lived just above that, put out a lot of influence there, and he took over a lot of the buildings. And he put the Chinese in there, because they worked for him also, and they worked for other people, and they had laundries, and they had they went in as cooks for people. So that was a pretty good place. But they had sometimes 10, 15 men living in these little shacks. There's only a couple of pictures that exist of the buildings. But they lived there probably up until the 1890s. Is that what you'd say, Chelsea?
On the north side of the block, it burned in 1888. And on the south side of the block, there were a few houses that were occupied into the 20th century, at least through 1910 or so.
And I've heard two stories on this. One, it was burned deliberately to get the Chinese out of there. Others, the Chinese had left already because by that time the railroad was being built, and it was just burned to get rid of the vermin and buildings.
There are accounts later after that 1888 fire saying, hey, let's burn down these shanties. So I don't know if there was intentional burning on the other side of the block, but the fire that took out the block where we're actually going to be excavating also took out the Lynn Planning Mill and some of the other buildings that they certainly wouldn't have wanted to burn on purpose. Maybe the fire got out of hand. I don't know. But one thing that kind of ties in with all of this is, part of, you know, doing the archaeology, we have a lot of research questions that, you know, we're hoping we can fill in the gaps in history. There's not a lot that was written by the Chinese that were living in Jacksonville, and a lot of the stuff written about them was very biased and had an agenda, of course. And one of the things that's interesting to me is when everybody came to Jacksonville in 1851, it's still the Oregon Territory. So it's a contested area. There isn't really anybody that you know, besides the Native Americans, who's really from there.
And no real central government, for sure.
Yeah. So, but somehow, very quickly, as certain people in the population try to, you know, they're nation building. They're trying to turn this into a state. They want to get accepted into the Union. They want to create this very deliberate kind of landscape. And some people become more foreign than others. and the Chinese, Native Hawaiian, African Americans, these populations, Indians as well, are excluded from buying land, from they're discouraged from owning businesses through taxes and fees placed on them. They're feed for mining. They can't testify in courts. There's all these laws that go into effect that create a sort of a perpetual foreignness that the Chinese fall into. They can't become Americans because they can't buy land. They can't own businesses. There's all these things that are kind of deliberately push them into the margins of society going on at that time.
So in terms of the Chinese Quarter itself, I mean, there was obviously de facto physical segregation. Was it de jure too? I mean, was it like you could not have you could not be Chinese and own a place on the other side of Third Street or something?
No, that's definitely not the case. And in fact, there's some tantalizing accounts in like the court ledgers about brothels that were busted outside of the Chinese enclave. And so one of my research questions going into it is how permeable is this neighborhood? You know, the neighborhood's gone today, and a lot of times we tend to think about it as just this totally isolated thing that was in the center of town but distinctly on the edge. And, you know, I think that even though what survive are these documents that talk about some of the more racial and discriminating laws against the Chinese, but I think on an interpersonal level, I'm curious how they interacted with their neighbors. I know Peter Britt, who's next door, definitely, I don't know if they were good friends, but they definitely had a lot of business agreements, and they definitely interacted to a greater degree than one would assume if the Chinese were just restricted within the Chinese Quarter.
So, and I want to ask this of Larry Smith, though, because there are so many names that come out of the history of Jacksonville, which are still out there today because of the fact that, in a sense, they're still present because of the way that Jacksonville maintains history in the midst of modernity. But like C.C. Beekman and Peter Britt, you already mentioned, these are pillars of the community, but it sounds like they didn't really necessarily rise above the rest of the folks in their time. They were still people of their time and had similar attitudes about the Chinese population.
On your website, you have a picture of Beekman's houseboy.
Right.
Even though he was a man, they still called him a houseboy. And his relationship with the family was rather interesting. He'd come into the house to cook, clean, take care of things, prepare their dinners. But then when it came time for actually sitting down, then he just excused himself out to his little cabin and back. Then he would come back in. Christmas, she'd help him put on the Christmas celebrations. But then he would have to excuse himself when the celebration actually happened. I think he was there about 30 years, they estimate. And he took care of the place when the Beekmans were traveling, so he had full run of the property and the house and so on. Peter Britt never did really, to my study, ever have a Chinese that actually worked full-time in the house like the Beekmans had, but he had a lot of people working for him. Mm-hmm. The big water ditch, the Ziegler Trail that we have today, that water ditch was dug by the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of accounts of Peter Britt renting to Chinese, or even one account said he operated a bank. And in fact, as Larry said, a lot of the Chinese quarters.
The bank was out of his back pocket.
Yeah. A lot of the buildings within a certain section of the Chinese Quarter were owned by Peter Britt. So he probably, you know, maybe rented out some of those buildings within the town. But I've done a lot of excavation in the Britt homestead as well. And we do find Chinese artifacts. And it's not some of the stuff you'd expect to be on a mantle or some really fancy thing. We get some of the utilitarian rice bowls and some of the stuff that you see in the Chinese Quarter also. So where those relationships, how they overlap, I don't know. And it's one of the things that I like to kind of compare the two populations, because Peter Britt, of course, is just as foreign as the Chinese when he comes to Jacksonville. He's from Switzerland, and he, you know, when we compare those two assemblages archaeologically, they're very similar. Peter Britt is eating traditional dishes. He's using imported goods. The Chinese might be smoking opium, but Peter Britt is drinking absinthe. So they're both they both brought a lot of their home life with them to Jacksonville. And somehow what happened after is where things really become different. The story is different.
I'm curious, when you were talking about looking at the court documents, because if these are people who really were excluded from being able to serve on juries or do a lot of other things that citizens would be able to do, it sounds like you're trying to figure out a lot of things by the absence of some records, really.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting is most of the accounts are restrictive, but there are also some accounts hidden in there, like when you go through the commissioner's journal. Just like everybody else in town that has to either work on the roads or pay to, you know, pay somebody else to do it for them in their stead, the Chinese are helping build the infrastructure that benefits everybody in town. So it's not just mining and sticking to themselves. They're also building the community. But you don't see them, and there's probably a lot of different reasons for this. There was a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier, there's a religious barrier in a lot of accounts or instances. But there's a lot of places where they're absent, and that's where we hope the archaeology can contradict, enhance, supplement the documentary record.
And something you said a couple of minutes ago, Chelsea, about the occupation, that there are some indications that there were at least some Chinese people still living there till about 1910.
Yeah.
But that's about it then. So basically for more than a century now, there's been no Chinese presence in Jacksonville. No part of the original colony, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So there are accounts of, like, oral history accounts of people that lived there in the turn of the century, white people. And there's some instances where they talk about, oh, yeah, we got along fine with the people in the Chinese Quarter. Or there's a few accounts I've seen where somebody remembered a Chinese woman giving them candy when they were kids. So, you know, there is some overlap, and it doesn't – I don't get the sense that the average citizen is anti-Chinese. They're just curious.
Much more to talk about the dig in China, in Jacksonville, in the Chinese Quarter, coming up in Jacksonville next weekend. Chelsea Rose and Larry Smith are guests here on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have some questions about our attitudes toward people of non-white races in the area back in many years ago. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Back with Chelsea and Larry and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're digging into the past, in a sense, here on the Jefferson Exchange today, talking about an excavation in the Chinese Quarter of Jacksonville, Oregon, once the county seat, once the center of mining and industry in Jackson County. No longer so, but a well-preserved historic district as the downtown area. And we're talking about the excavation that will actually involve a chance for the public to watch the process. Chelsea Rose is an archaeologist with the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, which we tend to call Sula more often than not. And Larry Smith is a retired teacher from Jacksonville, 33 years at Jacksonville Elementary, but still subbing quite a bit, and a historian as well. You can join us here in the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the process of digging into the past and what that past represents. 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chelsea, we've talked about this a bit obliquely up to this point about exactly where this dig is going on, in the former Chinese Quarter, somewhere along Main Street, I gather, involving a sidewalk.
Well, anybody who's been to Jacksonville knows it's very small, so you can go there and yell my name and we'll find you. But we are on Main Street, which is, if you're heading out of town up towards the Applegate, it's just parallel to California Street, which is the highway. And it's a really short little block. It's kind of at an angle right behind La Fiesta and on your way up to the Brit, if you were to go the roadway. And
it actually does head uphill pretty steeply toward the end of that block.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
It does. Yeah. So, and we'll be out there. We're going to be working on the site throughout the week, but we're opening it up to the public so people can come out, see what we're doing, see the artifacts, and get excited about it. We try to do that whenever we can, whenever we have a project that's interesting enough or there's not safety issues or something like that, just so that we can share in the discovery of what we're finding and people can understand why archaeology is interesting and important, and it reinforces that it is all around us and that it's something that's worth protecting and paying attention to.
So how big an area are you digging? I mean, just on the surface, what are the measurements?
It's 2 meters by 2 meters.
Wow. Six feet by 6 feet. Then.
Yeah, so it's
then.
Small. So, and those are calculations based on the anticipated disturbance of the project. So, you know, we always are preservation-minded when possible. So we don't want to take all of it out because every year archaeology gets better and better tools. So probably within my career, we'll be able to go out there with like a DNA ray gun or something and get all sorts of new information. I mean, artifacts are microscopic already. So we want to preserve some because we know in the future people will theoretically be better situated to recover more data out of the soil. But at the same time, we do want to make sure we get a good sample. There's been over the last decade, there's been three excavations out there by the University of Oregon and then by us. And we have thousands and thousands of artifacts, but what we don't have are features, so like building foundations or parts of the structures. And so I think I know exactly what building we're in, but I'm hopefully going to try to anchor that in by finding a wall or something that's more diagnostic. And then that helps us take our analysis to the next level, from the level of what were people doing in the Chinese Quarter to what were the people doing in this house.
And so what sorts of things, you mentioned some things are down to the microscopic level already,
yeah.
But what are the things you tend to find that aren't walls and other bits of structure?
Well, just in a very small hole, we pulled out over 2,000 artifacts a couple years ago when we did this initial excavation. And the Chinese archaeological sites tend to be really rich. Because like Larry said, they imported a lot of the food and the goods. So we find a lot of these imported rice bowls with very distinctive patterns. We find a lot of stoneware food storage containers, like for dried vegetables and meats and stuff like that. And then we also find tons and tons of, in this particular instance, we found a lot of bones, so the remains of food, and then also some seeds and stuff like that preserved as well. So it's like they're compost. And that's really fascinating, because if people aren't really talking about the daily life of the Chinese, they certainly are not talking about what they're eating. So that's something that really gives us a lot of information. Like Larry said, you know, how varied is their diet? You know, there's little things in there that look like peanuts. I think they're lychee nuts or something like that. We're getting them analyzed now, but so it's exciting stuff.
Which raises the question then, because so much of what you find at archaeological digs is things like broken bits of pottery and stuff that was discarded at some point. So I'm starting to think that if our generation of people gets really good at recycling, reusing, composting, all that, you'll never know what the heck we were doing in our time in history.
It's true. It's a little bit different. I think about it. I was trying to explain this to someone recently. When we were up at the Peter Britt site, for example, we found a toothbrush. So we know who lived there over time, and if we can figure out the date of this toothbrush, we can get within a few people of whose toothbrush that is. So where do our toothbrushes go nowadays? They go way out in a landfill somewhere. So, you know, archaeologists in the future are going to have their own different strategies for dealing with that. But again, it's all guided by the research questions. So we, you know, maybe somebody in the future won't care about the same kind of things we care about because we're documenting our lives in different ways. But so it's always trying to get at the things that get overlooked or the gaps in those in our understanding about the past. And also it's very informed by what we're curious about now. So, you know, going back into this dig, we're researching specific things that we want to find out about. So we'll, you know, that's what we're looking for.
Let's take some calls. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the dig in Jacksonville's Chinese Quarter with Chelsea Rose and Larry Smith.
Yes, two questions. One, the Chinese wanted to be buried in China. Is that correct?
That is, Larry, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay,
in fact, they made a solemn promise to each other, and they paid into a fund that would ensure that their bones got taken back to China.
Okay, and, so Mark, go ahead, Chelsea.
Oh, and it's not because they didn't think American soil was good enough. That's kind of some of the racist ideas of the time. It's because they have a longstanding tradition of ancestor relationships with the living. So they have different ways that they, you know, pay tribute and interact with their ancestors.
Right, it would be rather difficult for them to interact with their ancestors if they were buried in the United States.
Thousands of miles away,
and,
right.
And interestingly, nowadays, when the population is increasingly moving over here, there's a lot of Chinese Americans now, the tradition is reversed. So people are now excavating remains from China and bringing them over to America for the very same reasons, so they can have access to their ancestors.
That is fascinating. Mark, you had more to your question, I gather.
And one more. Were the Chinese included in the census in 1860, 70, and so on?
Yes, they were. And if they could find them, sometimes they just put down Chinaman. That's all they put down. Mm-hmm. And so you could get a count that way. But they didn't go into all the camps, but they had upwards of 300. I think it was in 1860, they had about 300 on the census.
In Oregon or
Jackson County?
Just Jackson County alone.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Mark, any more to your questions?
Covers it. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Jacob and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Larry Smith and Chelsea Rose.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, so I want to point out what we'll leave as our legacy to future archaeologists in 100 years. And see what's around you right now. You know, like your computer or your radio or your clock or your desk or your furniture. And, like, the most favorite thing that we have mostly is, like, our iPhones, our mobiles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
and,
we got drawers.
You know, our electronics and anything electric. But basically, those are all made in China. You know, and we're going to be, I mean, like, if your favorite thing, your Xbox or your iPhone, you might be buried with that. You know, in the future, we're going to find stuff in Oregon that was made in China, and somebody's going to have to explain how this Chinese-made product, you know, this iPhone or iPad, came all the way, you know, 3,000 miles from China.
They could make some really wrong assumptions about our culture then, couldn't they, Jacob?
Well,
yeah, but what I'm pointing out is how linked, even today, we're actually more linked to China than we were 100 years ago. And we'll probably be more linked in 100 years from now.
All right. Thanks for that, Jacob. Appreciate it.
One thing to keep in mind, too, people living in Jacksonville in the 1850s and 60s, there was very, very little produced locally. So even though it seems like they would have been totally cut off, they were very immersed in a global marketplace. So it wasn't just Chinese individuals that were getting stuff imported. Everybody was getting stuff imported from all over. The shipping, you know, the easiest way to get to Southern Oregon at the time was still via boat and then overland from the coast. So,
you mentioned the changes in techniques in archaeology. Just in the in the length of your career then, Chelsea, I mean, has there been much of a change? I mean, are you still throwing dirt through screens in the whole process?
Yeah, I mean, we always try to keep samples of the soil and stuff like that. But some of the technologies that have been around for a while are becoming more inexpensive and therefore more accessible to, you know, more common on research projects. So there's a lot more, we have a lot more access to remote sensing techniques, so different radars and magnetometry and stuff like that, so we can get a better idea of what's under the ground before we dig, and therefore we can target our excavations and not destroy, you know, like really confine the amount that we actually dig up. There's also, we can do different soil analysis, we can analyze pottery, we can do DNA, people have got DNA off of artifacts before, for sure. And then we can also, you know, source, when we're talking about the Native Americans living in the area, we can source the obsidian. Where were they bringing it in from? You know, so there's a lot of stuff now that maybe people did only every once in a while where they had a good budget for a project that now is a lot more accessible to everyday archaeology.
I remember talking to the guys working with the ground penetrating radar not terribly long ago and realizing that it wasn't that they were looking for stuff buried. They were actually looking for soil compaction indicating where things had stood.
Yeah. Yeah, so those techniques can apply to a lot of different fields, and it's all about the interpretation. So archaeology has always kind of grabbed stuff from everybody to try to see what we can turn to our advantage.
And that's really where the anthropology comes in, isn't it? Trying to run it through the screen of what you know about your current culture, but also what you know about the other ones as well, things that are outside the box of your own thinking of your own time. Let's take another call. Here's Ray in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chelsea Rose and Larry Smith.
Good morning. I apologize if this sounds a little redundant because I came in late on your show, but in Waldo, Oregon, out of Cave Junction, Tequilma area, there was a pretty large population of Chinese miners, and there's a fairly significant Chinese graveyard out there. But the question I had was, have you heard of a wealthy Chinese businessman who paid to have a number of the bones excavated from the burial sites and flown back to China because of religious reasons?
All right. Thanks for the call, Ray. Appreciate it. Larry and Chelsea look a little stumped.
Yeah. Well, we did go over some of that there was a lot of there was a Chinese cemetery in Waldo, and a lot of the graves are exhumed. But it wasn't necessarily a wealthy businessman. And I'm sure Larry can speak to this more. People came in and made arrangements a lot of times when they came to America about there was benevolent societies and different ways they could arrange to have their remains sent home.
They had paid into a so-called insurance fund ahead of time with a promise, but they didn't get around to sending their bones home until the 1920s when a guy showed up in Jacksonville and they pointed him to the cemetery and he said he was getting $20 a piece for digging up the bones, and they're quite sure that he took off quite a few extra bones too while he was at it.
Really? Extra bones?
Yeah. There were people up there that weren't necessarily identified, and he just grabbed them because he got $20 for a set of bones.
Oh,
and he was,
okay.
They're quite sure there are quite a few white folks mingled with the ancestors back in China.
Now, there's a whole, there's quite a ritual involved with the repatriation of the bones, isn't there?
Yes.
And the polishing
organizing. Yeah, and they have to lay things out just right, and they have to say these certain words and put smoke over the top of them, incense and so forth. Yes, it wasn't just digging them up.
We have an email here from Ina or Ina in Eugene. She says, greetings to Chelsea. I'm so glad that you continue the excavations in Jacksonville. Learning about the role of the Chinese community in Jacksonville is an important contribution to memory culture of the region. All best wishes for your work.
Oh, that's one of my professors at the U of O. Hello. Thank you.
Excellent. So this is like trying to put together a puzzle, it sounds like, when you're doing a dig like this and you have like maybe one corner piece and two from the middle and one from the edge. You're really trying to make a bunch of assumptions with not a lot to go on, it sounds like.
It's true. And one thing to keep in mind is archaeology as a science. So we do follow the scientific method, and we do try to, we don't just make blind leaps in logic. And sometimes you have to kind of take a leap, but you always, you know, have the qualifiers. Maybe this is what this means. But there's so many different things to learn about, and I've never worked on a project where at the end of it we didn't have more questions than answers, so you just find more questions as you go along. And it's a continuum, and it's a dialogue I'll work on for the rest of my career. Other people will pick up where I leave off, or, you know, other people are also looking at the same types of populations. They have their own research interests. We build off each other. So, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, my research here is informed by the research going on across America, for sure, at the same population, the same time period. You know, we all kind of work together on this.
So for the folks who do want to come out for the public dig on the 12th, what time of day and what can they do other than watch you work?
Well, we will be there from 10 to 2, and people, I don't know how much we'll still be doing. The holes will be open. We'll have a lot of the artifacts out for showing and telling. We'll be cleaning some artifacts. We'll talk about what happens next. We'll explain what we think we found. There'll be other representatives from the Jacksonville community talking about the history. And then also, if they want to stick around and have lunch, and then later that afternoon they can head over to the Meet the Pioneers event in the Jacksonville Cemetery to learn even more about the history of Jacksonville.
Final question to Larry Smith, then, as a longtime Jacksonville resident. What do you make of all this history involving the Chinese folks in Jacksonville and the fact that Jacksonville, without that original Chinese population, celebrates Chinese New Year now?
Well, that Chinese New Year's kind of got started through a kind of a guilt trip because they said we didn't treat them very well. But what I'd like to really concentrate on is the lasting effect that the Chinese have had on the Rogue Valley through the agriculture, the railroad. The railroad was built by the Chinese. In fact, at one time, there were 2,000 Chinese working on the railroad, supporting 500 white men. And so we have a lasting legacy in this valley because of the Chinese.
All right. Well, I'm glad you guys came in to talk about that legacy and about the excavation going on in Jacksonville on October 12th. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, thank you so much. Larry Smith, retired teacher and historian from Jacksonville, thank you. Good to have you again. And that'll do it for the Jefferson Exchange. On Monday, we'll be talking about Shasta County's Most Wanted with Redding's police chief. We'll talk about Oregon's tuition equity program. And we'll talk to the author of the book Drama High about a high school in Pennsylvania that really put out some great productions that really sent some ripples through the community and the lives of the people involved. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening, and please have a great weekend.